Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Asaf Lewin, software manager for SpaceIL, the extraordinary Israeli lunar project. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our young Shinshiniot, Ron Benicote and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Hanukkah is nearly here, beginning tonight, December 2nd at sundown. The eight nights of Hanukkah represent an opportunity to renew our commitment to Jewish identity. And an interesting key to this festival is the time of day, or rather, night. As you probably know, all Jewish holidays begin at sundown, but none are quite so night-oriented as Hanukkah, not even Passover. Bringing light into the season of the shortest days and longest nights of the year, Hanukkah is that rare Jewish holiday in which nearly all the observances are after dark. Sure, it's Hanukkah during the days too, but it's the magical lighting of Chanukiot, Hanukkah menorahs or candelabra lit every night of the long festival, adding one more light each night that's the central observance of Hanukkah. We are commanded to fulfill the great mitzvah of Pirsomet HaNes, publicizing the miracle of God's redemption at this time of year in those days long ago. And nothing does that better than lights burning brightly in the window, reminding us of the miraculous quality of God's redemption. I invite you to pray for the redemption of my voice in the next few days as well. Maybe I'll get a Hanukkah miracle there too, after a flu. Anyway, although Hanukkah is considered a minor holiday on the Jewish religious calendar, in America, it has become something quite major. In part, this is because of the proximity to that other end of the American calendar year holiday that everybody likes to celebrate so thoroughly. You know, Kwanzaa. Anyway, in part, it's also because Hanukkah is a festival that celebrates religious freedom, the right to worship God as we choose. Without the events we commemorate at Hanukkah, the victory of the small Jewish guerrilla band led by the Maccabees over the mighty Syrian Greek army of the Seleucid Empire in the years 167 to 165 BCE, without that, the belief in one God would have been destroyed and religious freedom eliminated. There would have been no Jews, which means no Christians, no Western civilization, for that matter, no Muslims either. Both Christianity and Islam are direct daughter descendant religions of Judaism. It's a constant reminder that religious freedom has to be protected, now and in those days long ago. The story of the Great Revolt, catalyzed by the egotism of King Antiochus IV Epiphanes and his need not only to be obeyed but also worshipped, is an underdog narrative, how a group of Jews refused to bow down to an idol or surrender their right to study Torah and educate their children in belief in God and the moral and practical principles of Judaism. They fought and died and eventually triumphed. And when they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, they cleansed it, relit the great menorah, and dedicated it anew to worship and holiness, called a Chanukat Habayit. The word Hanukkah itself means dedication. When we celebrate this week, eating anything fried in oil, especially latkes, the fabulous potato pancakes, by the way, I have a great sweet potato latke recipe, we are celebrating something more than a children's festival. We're enjoying our religious freedom, which was defended and reestablished nearly 2,200 years ago by the Maccabees. And religious freedom for all religions is a great Jewish ideal worth fighting for, in their day and in ours. To play us in this morning for Hanukkah, here's a contemporary classic, my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan's setting of Pitachta from the Hanukkah Psalm. I have removed my clothes of mourning and robed myself in joy, as recorded by our house rock band, Avanim. La 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 la
saki, ay pitaka, saki saki, ay pitaka, saki saki, vata's rain is in pa, vata's rain is in pa.
That was Pitachta from the Psalm for the Holiday of Hanukkah, which begins at sundown tonight. Our guest this morning is Asaf Lewin, head of software engineering for the extraordinary new Israeli space program and its upcoming lunar flight. That's right, Israel is going to the moon. Talk about a Hanukkah miracle. Find out about this amazing enterprise when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
To greet our guest from Space IL, the Israeli Lunar Project, here's a little bit of a classic Alan Sherman song.
My name is Mr. Bloom and I'm from New Rochelle, and I sing this happy tune because my son, the astronaut, young Harvey Bloom, has landed on the moon. My wife and I, we miss our little Harvey so, back here in New Rochelle, that every single night in the pale moonlight, we walk out on the patio and yell, shine on Harvey Bloom. Up in the sky, you have been in orbit since January, February, June, and July. Don't come back too soon. We rented out your room. So shine on Harvey Bloom up there on the moon.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish Asaf Lewin. He is the head of software development for Space IL, the Israeli Lunar Project, something that I never thought I'd be able to say on air. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Hello. Hi there.
So it's very exciting to think about Israel, conquering space somehow. Israel's a very small country to be involved in this. Tell us a little bit about how the whole program evolved.
Well, the whole program evolved about 10 years ago following a project proposed by XPRIZE, the XPRIZE organization, which is an organization, a nonprofit organization that submits competitions, worldwide competitions, for various things that that benefit mankind. And one of the projects, and this is the project that we joined, is called the Lunar XPRIZE competition, and where a private company should try to perform a soft landing on the moon using only private funds and moving about 500 meters on the moon, taking selfies, sending videos back to Earth. And the winner of this competition was supposed to win $20 million.
Rather a significant award, although in the world of space exploration, money somehow seems like no object. When the program began, was the goal to actually put an unmanned craft on the moon?
The goal was to put an unmanned craft on the moon, and actually, just referring to your previous comment, 20 million sounds a lot for three young guys who founded Space IL, and they really thought that they will come up with a profit after this competition.
Kinahara, as we say, yeah.
But in reality, it's basically almost impossible to do anything in less than $100 million. So they began the program with a plan to develop a very, very small Coca-Cola-sized spacecraft that will cost $2 million, and ended up with a spacecraft which is about 500 kilograms, which is like 1,000 pounds, and cost almost $100 million. So that's the dream, and that's reality. But still, it's a privately funded spacecraft to land on the moon, and that would be a first of its kind.
Really stunning. We do know there have been some private space enterprises like Elon Musk's SpaceX. There's now some interesting approaches to space. We will talk much more about how you got involved with it, what you do in terms of developing the software, and the whole Israeli lunar program when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue based in northwest Tucson, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson. Festive Shabbat Chanukah services, followed by latkes, will be held this Friday night, December 7th at 6:30 p.m., with Hanukkah and Shabbat, candle lighting, of course. Religious school and adult education academy courses are offered at the Temporary Educational Center on Oracle Road, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha and to attend services and adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-E, Simcha, S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or www.beitsimchatucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov.
And Chanukah Sameach, Chagurim Sameach.
Chanukah Sameach.
Tonight. Gaza is always in the news somehow. It's a constant problem. You know, a while back, Sharon thought if we just pull out, then we can treat him as a foreign country and we can attack and that'll solve the whole problem. Obviously, that hasn't worked. Nothing has worked, including a series of invasions, you know, defeating the Hamas militarily, bombing, letting it be reconstructed, blockading. Nothing really seems to be helping. What can be done? What's Israel's real approach to it now?
I think even the peace camp in Israel, you know, in the 90s, really thought about the possibility of having peace between the Palestinians and Israelis. I think that recently, unfortunately, it shifted not to peace, but live and let live. And really what we realistically think that will be possible, hopefully, is that they will just manage their own lives and leave us alone. We Israelis don't wake up in the morning and want to harm Palestinians. We Israelis don't want them to be hungry. We wish them all the best. We just need them to stop the incitement, telling that all Jews are bad and all Israelis are bad and need to be killed. And so that's something, a reality that needs to be changed. I hope that it will be, you know, education will be the key, that they will educate that people are people. And then instead of using mallet in Hebrew, so cement. Instead of using concrete and cement, you know, instead of doing attack tunnels to build houses and hospitals and schools, you know,
the money, all of the things.
The sad thing is that the money is out there. You know, there's enough money. If it's an American money, if it's European money, if it's even Saudi Arabia money, there's so much money that can really solve the problem in Gaza. But in order to solve it, you need leaders who will take that money and use it for the right causes and not to their Swiss bank account. Because that's what really happens. You know, the poor people suffer and the leaders there enjoy life.
You know, it's been such a challenge. And when Hamas threw out Fatah in the civil war, which was a shock to a lot of people, but maybe not a shock to people, probably wasn't a shock to Israeli intelligence.
No.
Because Fatah has always been very corrupt. Mm-hmm. Hamas looked like it would be less corrupt. That doesn't look so good now.
No.
Can anybody mediate, you know, on this ceasefire, supposedly
Egypt
yeah. and was it Egypt and
Qatar
of yeah. all places, right? Yeah. Qatar and yeah. I don't remember, was it Russia, EU, somebody else got involved. There was a bunch of partners.
Yeah, there are people who wanted to meet. To help the situation.
I hope there is some help for it, because it doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't do the south of Israel any good. It
doesn't do good to the Palestinians.
It doesn't do the Palestinians certainly any good.
Right.
And it doesn't do Israel any good in the long run. It's certainly bad PR no matter how you look at it.
Right.
Well, maybe this Hanukkah will get a miracle.
Hopefully we'll have a miracle, Rabbi.
Thanks, Amir. We'll talk next week.
You're welcome.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the different reactions to the Pittsburgh Tree of Life massacre and how Israelis perceived American Jews as perhaps somewhat naive about the rise of anti-Semitism, or the relevance of anti-Semitism, how this made us a little bit more like Jewish communities everywhere else in the world. I'm reminded of the very first guest we ever had on Too Jewish, Professor Leonard Dinnerstein, who wrote the book Anti-Semitism in America, who basically said 15, 16 years ago, anti-Semitism is declining. It's basically gone in America, or almost gone in America at the time. We really can't say that now.
Right. I remember Leonard because he created what became the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies
Indeed.
At the University of Arizona.
Right.
And when I first started teaching there, he was still an active presence, kind of on the margins. And he made that claim in conversation with me several times, because I was teaching a history of anti-Semitism. And he said, you know, I hope you make it clear that it's only in the past. Well, I never believed that for a minute. I do think it was pretty deeply buried, and it was no longer sort of politically correct or socially acceptable to express overtly anti-Semitic views in the United States. And Jews convinced themselves, maybe for the sake of convenience or peace of mind, that when people did express views that might be considered anti-Semitic, they were really questioning the politics of whatever the current regime in Israel was. And they were expressing anti-Israel sentiments, which may or may not have been legitimate, but doing so in anti-Semitic terms. So it wasn't real anti-Semitism. It wasn't the old-fashioned Nazi kind of anti-Semitism.
Or anti-Israelism, not anti-Semitism.
And above all, it wasn't the kind of anti-Semitism that sent most of our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents from the Tsarist Empire to America in the final years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century. I'm not sure, and I never was sure, that that argument was right. I think it retreated and didn't show its ugly face because it was illegitimate, and we were in an age of developing civil rights and recognizing same-sex marriage and all this stuff. So in that context, it was grossly inappropriate to express old-fashioned anti-Semitism. But there were always institutions, both Jewish and non-Jewish, that kept track of anti-Semitic incidents in the United States. How many per year? How violent were they? What was their nature? Where did they happen? And all of those institutions noticed a dramatic spike right after the election of the current president. Now, I would be the last one to suggest that the current president sponsors or encourages anti-Semitism. But the mere fact that he won the election encouraged people with very politically unacceptable views, very ugly views of Jews and African Americans and other minorities, to crawl out from under the rocks and express themselves either verbally or through violent actions. And I think that's what we saw in Pittsburgh. That's what we saw at the cemetery in St. Louis, where my great-grandmother is buried, like 2 weeks after the election, even before the current president was in office. So I think we live in a dangerous time, not only for Jews, but for other minorities, and even for immigration, people seeking asylum, et cetera, et cetera. There's been an abrupt turnaround, and I think a group of your rabbinic colleagues are about to protest this as dramatically as they know how.
Right, right. It's true. It's, you know, sometimes the unintended consequences are really horrible. And we're seeing this with that kind of rise in anti-Semitism. For a long time, it was perceived, oh, that's kind of an, all the anti-Semitism is coming on campus and it's on the left wing, if you will, and it's Arabist. And that's not never been exactly true. And now there's a perception it's coming from the right and neo-Nazi and Aryan Nation stuff. And while there is certainly truth to that, it's not like it's gone on either end. It's just something we need to really be conscious of and work against. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to seeing you next week.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one's a modern Hanukkah classic joke. A woman walks into the post office to buy stamps for her Hanukkah cards. She says to the clerk, "May I have 50 Hanukkah stamps, please?" "What denomination?" asks the clerk. And the woman answers, "Oy vey, has it come to this? Fine, fine. Give me 6 Orthodox, 12 Conservative, and 32 Reform Hanukkah stamps." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well.
We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot. Boker Tov and Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Chanukah Sameach.
Chagurim Sameach. It's a big holiday is about to begin. One of my favorite holidays. I know one of your favorite holidays. It is a big holiday in Israel, even though religiously it's not as important as Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, or the Shalosh Regalim. And yet, for Jews everywhere, it's so important. Tell us about how you guys celebrate Hanukkah, why it's good to you.
I celebrate Hanukkah. I try to do every day with lighting the Hanukkiah and being with my family. Every day is really important to me. Every day we go to someone else in the family, a different family member, and we light the candles there, and we sing songs, and we eat latkes and sufganiyot. And it's really fun, like, meeting all of your family and friends in such a long time for a lot of times in such a short period.
In a week, 8 days.
That was what I was trying to say.
And how about you, Ron?
So me and my mom always make homemade tufganiyot, and we invite all our family. We have a big family. And as the little kid in my family, I always insist on lighting the candles. And my dad is doing the bracha of the candles. And it's
Do you guys
really
sing
fun.
Songs? Yes, do you play sevivon? You play dreidel?
We sing Mao's Tzur.
Mao's Tzur.
Yeah, and all the cousins. You see all the little cousins with the dreidels.
Competition.
Yeah, exactly. It's really fun.
So, you know, when I lived in Jerusalem, one of the really wonderful parts about Hanukkah was people put their Hanukkiyot in these kind of glass boxes outside the house just to let them burn. And they'd make oil ones. They'd burn like all night. It was beautiful everywhere. Do you guys put them in the window? Do you put them outside? How do you do it?
So we put ours in the window so people could
see it.
Everybody
can see?
Yeah, right? Everyone could see it when they are passing by. It's really nice just because you suddenly see the whole neighborhood just
all
light
lit up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's really nice. You really get that Hanukkah vibe. You can walk around and see Hanukkah, and it's really nice. I like it.
So I understand there are now all kinds of shows in Israel that they do over Hanukkah. So tell us about that.
There is a show called Festigal, yep, which is a yearly show in Israel that is happening on Hanukkah. I see Ron is really excited
She's
about this.
She's going out of her mind right now. Looking. She's like about to explode.
I think she can explain better.
I'm not sure she can speak. She's so excited about Festigal.
It's kind of like a musical, and it happens every year during Hanukkah. I used to go every year ever since I was like 3 with my family, and I love it. It's all the famous people in Israel singing, dancing. All the songs get really famous after, and it's just really fun.
It's like the greatest Hanukkah on earth.
Exactly.
It's a wonderful celebration. Well, listen, I hope you have a fantastic Hanukkah. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Eat many latkes and sufganiyot and have a wonderful, wonderful 8 nights.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayigash begins with the climax of the great Joseph story that fills the last sections of the book of Genesis. Joseph is the powerful ruler of Egypt, richest country in the ancient world. His miraculous ascent from slavery and then prison to the heights of political power is the stuff dreams are made of. Joseph is the master of all he surveys, subservient only to a pharaoh who trusts him completely. He is handsome, rich, hugely powerful, well-dressed, with a wife and 2 fine sons, completely assimilated into Egypt's elegant culture, and still comparatively young. The world sits at his manicured feet. But wait, there's more. For into this idyllic scene blunder Joseph's early tormentors, the very half-brothers who taunted him and beat him up. These are the conniving thugs who stripped him and tossed him into a pit in the earth and then sat down to eat lunch, debating in his hearing whether to kill him or just abandon him to thirst and starvation. And then they sold him into slavery in a foreign land instead. Now, 20 years later, he has the opportunity to return the favor, to exact at least a psychological vengeance on these half-brothers. After a sequence of twists and turns, Joseph has manipulated these brothers into a state of confusion and terror, unmanned the arrogant, unruly rural ruffians into fearful submission. He has had his dish of revenge served cold, and seems to have enjoyed it. And then something changes in Joseph. Perhaps he simply tires of psychologically torturing his half-brothers. Perhaps it is that he has finally seen his full brother Benjamin again, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. Perhaps it is that the fullest measure of revenge is magnanimity. Perhaps it's simply that Joseph's exceptional ability to act pragmatically exerts itself. He must end the cat-and-mouse game one way or another. Or perhaps it's the stirring confessional speech his powerful half-brother Judah delivers that brings Joseph to a new place. Whatever the reason, now, near the beginning of Vayigash, in the dramatic high point of this story, Joseph chooses to reunite with his family. He sends his advisors, counselors, and courtiers from the room. Overcome by emotion, he cries out in a voice loud enough to be heard by all and tells the brothers that he is Joseph. Weeping, he embraces his brother Benjamin and asks, "Is my father still alive?" One can only imagine the shock of that moment, even now, some 3,600 years after the events. The brothers may have had an inkling that he was indeed Joseph. It's implied in the text of the story. But the full revelation would have been stunning nonetheless. Their worst fears were realized. They have been and are now completely in the power of a despised half-brother they comprehensively wronged. What will happen? Joseph moves immediately to reassure them, to relieve their fears. He gently reminds them that he is the authority now, however. Everyone will move down to Egypt and live in land that he provides. Even his elderly father Jacob comes down to Egypt. The family is reassembled, but in a very different configuration, for the unquestioned new patriarch is Joseph. And the great story continues in a new land and a new direction. There is something about this story that compels us to examine our assumptions about just how things work in the world. Unpredictable things occur. What we expect is often not what occurs. Fate may play a role. The last can rise to first. Justice may ultimately be done. And in the best of circumstances, and with God's help, our own actions, like Joseph's, can begin with base motivation, yet finally rise to a level of magnanimity and grace. When we return on Two Jewish, our guest, Asaf Lewin, head of software engineering for the very first Israeli lunar project, will tell us what it's like to bring the Jewish state to the moon. Hear more about this amazing project when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It's official now. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is blocking U.S. military aid to Israel. Paul, who has previously called for cuts on U.S. defense assistance to Israel, recently put a hold on the U.S.-Israel Security Assistance Authorization Act of 2018, which codifies into law the $38 billion defense aid package for Israel over 10 years, negotiated in the final days of the Obama administration. A hold is a parliamentary procedure that allows senators to prevent a motion from reaching a floor vote. The U.S. Senate passed the act in early August. The House of Representatives followed suit the following month. Now the Senate must pass a final version in line with the bill passed by the House after adjustments. AIPAC has bought advertisements on Facebook that identify Paul as the main blocking force on the act. Meanwhile, Christians United for Israel, CUFI, sent out an action alert email blast this week to its supporters, calling on them to flood Senator Rand Paul's office with calls and letters encouraging him to support the legislation. CUFI has also invested heavily in ads in Kentucky to target the senator's constituents directly on the issue. Paul, a presidential candidate himself in 2016, alienated pro-Israel Republicans almost as soon as he became a senator in 2011. He embraced his Congressman Father Ron Paul's longtime call to cut defense assistance to Israel. Rand Paul later backtracked, saying he regarded Israel as a close ally and would cut assistance only once it was clear the country was self-sufficient in its defense needs. The current hold on the funding comes as Israel faces major immediate threats from Hamas in Gaza, from Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, and from Iran. The $38 billion deal negotiated in 2016 is the most generous ever for Israel. The act also expands the stockpile of weapons the U.S. keeps in Israel, which may access the stockpile in wartime. It enhances Israel's qualitative military edge as well and urges space research cooperation between Israel and the United States. Seems appropriate in view of this morning's guest. It seems unlikely that Rand Paul's actions will change the ultimate level of U.S. military support for Israel, but we shall see. Arson investigators are trying to determine what started a fire in a Houston-area Orthodox synagogue. The fire was deliberately started last Wednesday evening at the Torah V'Chesed Synagogue. while dozens of members were inside studying. Police deputies entered the synagogue in southwest Tucson at about 9 o'clock after seeing flames on the roof of the building and ordered everybody out. Several members of the synagogue attempted to run back into the building to rescue the Sephardic Orthodox congregation's Torah scrolls, but firefighters stopped them from doing so and instead went back in themselves to bring out the five Torah scrolls. Two sustained some water damage, according to the report. I really want to thank the firefighters and police for their bravery, their sensitivity, and understanding. Rabbi Avraham Yagobian, the synagogue's rabbi, said, "We were willing to jump in there, even if some of us were arrested, just walk in and take those Torahs. We would take whatever damage to our bodies. We didn't want our holy articles being hurt. The firefighters saw how important it was. They were caring. No one was injured in the fire." Some of the people present studying in the synagogue said they heard an explosion before the fire started. It started in the back of the building, then spread into the attic and onto the roof, according to the Houston Fire Department. On the 10th anniversary of the coordinated terror attack on sites in Mumbai, India, the U.S. State Department offered a new reward of $5 million for information leading to the arrest of its planners and facilitators. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo offered solidarity with the people of India and the city of Mumbai on the 10th anniversary of the Mumbai terror attack. "We stand with the families and friends of the victims whose loved ones were lost in this act of barbarism, including six American citizens. The barbarity of 26/11 shocked the entire world." By that, he means that on November 26, 2008, 10 members of Lashkar-e-Taiba, an Islamic terrorist organization based in Pakistan, carried out a series of 12 coordinated shooting and bombing attacks throughout the Indian city of Mumbai. The Nariman Chabad house was among those specifically targeted locations. Six people were killed at the Chabad house, including the directors, Rabbi Gabriel Holzberg and his pregnant wife Rivka, and four other Israeli and American visitors to the Chabad. "It is an affront to the families of the victims that after 10 years, those who planned the Mumbai attack have not been convicted for their involvement. We call upon all countries, particularly Pakistan, to uphold their UN Security Council obligations to implement sanctions against the terrorists responsible for this atrocity, including Lashkar-e-Taiba and its affiliates," Pompeo said. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi recalled the attack in a tweet. "Tributes to those who lost their lives in the gruesome 26/11 terror attacks in Mumbai are solidarity with the bereaved families," Modi wrote. "A grateful nation bows to our brave police and security forces who valiantly fought the terrorists during the Mumbai attacks." And in other news, an era in the Reform Movement's leadership development is passing. Kutz Camp, the Union for Reform Judaism summer camp for teen leaders and an incubator for Jewish folk music, is closing. URJ President Rabbi Rick Jacobs, a former guest of Two Jewish, made the announcement last week, citing competition from other programs. The camp celebrated its 50th anniversary, July 4th, 2015. The summer session of 2019 will be Camp Kutz's last. Camp Director Melissa Fry explained that Kutz, once the only high-level leadership programming exclusively for teens, faces competition from youth programs at other Reform camps, adding that the ability to attract teens to Kutz has been in decline for over a decade. Rick Jacobs noted that many of our teens are looking for these remarkable programs closer to home and at different times of year. Throughout the next year, URJ camps across North America and NIFTY, North American Federation of Temple Youth, will join us in determining how to best bring the movement's renowned leadership programming directly to the teens in our network of camps and congregations. Rabbi Jacobs said the movement does not know yet what will become of the Kutz Camp facility located in Warwick, New York. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Asaf Lewin, is the head of software development for Space IL, the Israeli Lunar Project. We started talking earlier about the fact this was it's completely privately funded and organized program. There must be a lot of cooperation involved with government authorities, though, isn't there?
Basically, anybody who tries to build a spacecraft will have to take advantage of legacy and people who have already done things in space. So
As I mentioned earlier, it started as a competition, and 33 teams around the world registered for the competition. Basically, SpaceIL was the last team to register. Eventually, just to make a long story short, all teams closed, and the competition was over. But we decided to continue and fulfill our dream of landing on the moon and putting the Israeli state and Jewish flag on the moon. So we are heading for the launch.
So how long has this process been, and what do you see as the ultimate result?
The project began 10 years ago, and the first 5 years or so were basically raising the money. As I mentioned, a project like this costs a lot of money, and only once the team started getting real big amounts of cash from donors, Jewish donors, we really started ramping up, building the team, and finalizing the design for the spacecraft.
Tell us what the positive result will be for Israel, besides the pride of seeing the Israeli flag on the moon and knowing that Israel has made it to the moon.
Originally, when the team founded the SpaceIL, they founded it not as a company, as a commercial company, but as a nonprofit organization. And the idea was that we want to, our goal is to basically educate the young generation and to try to provide an inspiration for the young generation to dream big. And of course, there's the pride for this, our little Jewish nation, and having a Hebrew written on the moon surface and the Jewish flag on the moon surface. These are all our goals. So a success will be anything. First of all, just building the spacecraft and launching it is a big success for us in such a budget. And then, of course, reaching the moon, not even landing, just becoming a satellite to the moon would be a huge success for us. This would be the first Israeli spacecraft. Israel, as a nation, has developed many satellites around Earth, some of the communication satellites, scientific satellites, and, of course, military satellites. But this would be the first ever Israeli spacecraft to leave Earth. So that would be a success on its own. Of course, if we manage to capture the moon and become a satellite, that would be great. And then there's the landing itself, which is a difficult task. And we are really, really doing our best to make that a huge success. So any step along the way would be a success for us.
Absolutely. I should note that the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. The moon seems like the obvious target in a Jewish sense. The technological difficulty of landing anything on the moon, first of all, getting something into space beyond a satellite, even getting a satellite into space, not a small task. Tell us about what's been the most challenging in your work, since so much of this now must be software-oriented.
Just to give you some proportion, the last time a nation has soft-landed on the moon was in 2013, December 2013, where the Chinese, the great nation of the Republic of China, wanted to show that it's a part of the big boys club, together with the United States and former Russia, who have landed on the moon. So the Chinese landed a rover on the moon in 2013. It took them about $1.2 billion and about 1,200 engineers to do that. We are basically doing the same with a small team of less than 40 people and less than $100 million. So that is a huge challenge. And to be able to do that, we had to try to make things economic, real economic. And that means trying to take equipment that was originally planned for Earth and adopt it to space. So the actual landing on the moon is very difficult. And for instance, for that, we've taken a device that has normally been used on helicopters, and we've adapted, which is a laser Doppler range finder, and adapted it to vacuum and the very harsh environment of space.
This was a very, very difficult task. It sounds easy, but it cost millions of dollars just to do that. So it was very challenging. And of course, there's the control algorithm, because we don't have an astronaut. We don't have Armstrong sitting there on the stick and landing. We need a robot to do that. So the spacecraft is completely autonomous. It should be able to land in very difficult conditions. And of course, we have to plan for problems and errors and everything. And this robotic spacecraft has to be able to overcome these problems.
Fascinating. In the course of developing this program, how many people are involved with SpaceIL?
Organically, we are a team of about 40 people. Some of them are part-time, some of them are full-time. We have more than 100 volunteers. Most of the volunteers volunteer in our education department, and they basically go from class to class for all ages and provide the lectures and organize all kinds of events for young people, trying to ignite their imagination and passion for technology and STEM technology. So a majority of our volunteers are education-based, but some volunteers also volunteer for the engineering department of SpaceIL. In addition, we subcontract some of our tasks to companies such as the Israel Space Agency, with their expertise. For instance, they have equipment that we don't have to test the spacecraft. We've recently finished a lot of the tests that we have to pass the spacecraft, such as vibrations and radio interference and thermal vacuum and all kinds of inquisition-like tests that you have to pass a spacecraft before you really send it to space. So we do subcontract, therefore the actual team is larger.
I was thinking, you know, when you compare even 40 full and part-time employees to, the other private space entities, which are many hundreds of employees, to something like NASA, which is, I don't know, tens of thousands of employees. This is really a startup nation kind of approach to getting into space, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, this, the whole idea of this program and actually of the competition is to privatize space. Traditionally, space was managed and was owned by governments. And almost everything you see in space belongs to some kind of government, whether it's NASA or the European Space Agency or the Indian Space Agency or whatever. These are all governments, and they have huge budgets and very, very enormous organizations. What we see nowadays with Elon Musk and with the Jeff Bezos and this kind of incentive is the our goal to privatize space, to make space available for people and not just for governments. So this is where SpaceIL fits, trying to reduce the cost and make it something that private people can go to space.
So let's assume success. Always a difficult thing to do when dealing with a situation and an atmosphere or lack of atmosphere as harsh as getting a spacecraft all the way to the moon. What's the next step after? Let's assume you make it to the moon.
That's a good question. There's a lot of things happening nowadays in the world around space. There are big programs to get to the moon, to populate the moon and Mars. And believe it or not, but there are all kinds of requests for proposals from various organizations to provide technology and services to service people on the moon and on Mars. So we have already received requests to provide information and quotations for various services for lunar or Mars-based colonies. So I believe that there is an opportunity for after our successful landing.
Well, and I'm sure the requests were not for kosher food on the new lunar settlement.
I'm sure that there will be a request for kosher food. I mean,
I believe that we will have Jews on the moon, and there will be a need for kosher food.
In the course of working for Space.io, what's the most surprising thing that's happened?
That's a good question. When you build a spacecraft, there are constant surprises. Everything you do, when you start testing, things happen. And we've had surprises along the way where things didn't work. And I believe that, as you mentioned, we feel a bit like a startup, and we have to cope with malfunctions and with surprises. Subcontractors that were supposed to provide something don't provide it on time, or changes in launcher configuration or environment, all kinds of technical stuff. You constantly face surprises. But that's what makes it very, very exciting. And we are constantly facing challenges and managing to overcome them. And we're just looking forward for the launch.
Important question. When the launch is successful and the spacecraft is up, do you do a Shehecheyanu? Like, have you planned the celebration, or are you too busy to think about it?
First of all, I mean, just on a Jewish level, I wanted to mention that at least half of our system engineering department are Orthodox Jews. So I'm absolutely sure that we're going to have a big prayer before the launch, and in any critical phase, we're going to have lots of prayers.
There'll be a lot of praying going on. I think, frankly, even
a lot of praying in the mission.
I think the Chilonim are going to be praying very hard too in that moment. I think the non-Orthodox will also be praying.
Definitely. I mean, my father, who's passed away, he was a non-Orthodox person, but he had a very strong connection to Judaism and to our religion, and he taught me that we are not in control of everything, and there are times when we have to believe and pray, and this is probably going to be one of them.
I want to thank Asaf Lewin for a wonderful visit here on Two Jewish. I want to wish you bracha v'atzlacha, you know, blessing and great success with the Lunar Project. And may you go from strength to strength.
Thank you very much.
Where can people go to find out more about the Israeli Lunar Project?
First of all, you could go to our website, which is www.spaceil.com. We have a constant feed there where you can get the latest updates. And of course, during the launch itself, which is planned for the first quarter of 2019, we're going to have live streaming of the launch and a lot of live streams and hopefully beautiful pictures that we send from Earth and from Moon during our mission and our flight until our hopefully successful landing.
Can't wait. Thank you so much. When we come back on... You're very welcome. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Hopefully my full voice will be back by then. Our guest will be a friend, Rabbi Amy Shinerman, author of the new two-volume work, The Talmud of Relationships. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our twojewishradio.com website. Our playout this morning for Hanukkah is a new composition sent to us by a fan from Denver. It's a duo called Plum Varia, and it's called Hanukkah Light. It takes a more peaceful and somber approach to Hanukkah music. Really beautiful. My friends, may you have a Chag Hanukkah Sameach, a Chag Urim Sameach, a happy holiday of Hanukkah and of lights, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Peaceful nights, candles low, feelings grow.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.